Almost there. So, hey, folks, thanks for getting into the BAMP podcast. I am your sunburnt host, Mike Lafferty. And here we are on Writers Wednesday with Walt Rebilliard right below me. How you doing, Walt?
Hola.
Hola. Below him, our artist, British co-host, John Gibbons. How you doing, John?
I'm good.
All right. At the very bottom, our feature writer for today, Ryan Danks. And Ryan, we're talking about this post you had up on Medium about how your first book made 75K and you did it not by following conventional wisdom, as your subheading says. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I didn't follow conventional wisdom because I didn't know what that was at the time. But after the fact, when people were telling me, oh, you need this and you need that, that's when I realized, no, I don't, actually. But yeah, it made $75,000 over the course of about 2 years. The Kickstarter raised $13,000, so that definitely helped slingshot that. Nice.
Yeah.
And here's the book right here.
Yeah, Jade Punk: Tales from Kowtow City. It's a role playing game, so it's not a novel. So I don't want someone thinking I broke out with a novel making 75K. I did some things. I tried to follow all the rules that they said to do for RPGs, and I have found that it works for novels as well. And I found that certain things don't work. Like, I got an editor for that. Mm-hmm. And anyone who reads it can see that it is full of mistakes, massive mistakes. I had one guy say he couldn't even finish reading it because of just the grammar. which most people like the setting, though. I usually get nothing but positive feedback. The setting was great. The concepts of it, what it brings out, the short stories at the front of every chapter. And with an editor who did a terrible job, apparently, since everyone hates the grammar, I could have saved that money. And, you know, right now I'm reading X-Men, I think it's called Empire's End, novel. And I'm finding all kinds of mistakes in there that is professionally published. So one of my rules now is I don't use editors. I also don't beta read because you can beta read and edit for decades and never have a perfect book. So, you know, I use Grammarly. I have my wife look at it, which, you know, huge criticism because I'm her husband. So, you know, I go that route and I rarely have trouble. Now I do that. But for Jade Punk, though, it was, it's a platinum bestseller and it's full of mistakes. So the concept that you need a perfect product to go is that's the conventional idea. You got to work on your book for years. I don't see that as true. I think it's better to be fast and put out tons of content and get that core audience who's like, I don't care, I love you and I know you're human and make mistakes, I just want to see your stuff. I'd rather get that group.
I liked how this post was very like pragmatic, kind of nuts and bolts, like invest in the cover, because that's what sells your book, especially if you're talking, you know, in the ebook space.
Yes. Conrad Javier, it was my artist for most of it. So was Kurt Komoda. And then I can't remember the other. Nicole, can't remember her name. Sorry, it's been years. But I went all in on art. Everything was art. Same with Shadowcraft, though. And Shadowcraft, you do need... I mean, there has to be some substance behind the art. Shadowcraft isn't nearly as good of a seller. And I spent far more, probably triple the cost on art for Shadowcraft. Mm-hmm. But it definitely helps.
Yeah.
The art helps if you're going to Kickstarter, doesn't it, as well?
So Shadowcraft raised 12 grand at Kickstarter. So I had almost the same amount of money. I doubled the art spend. I made a quarter of the income. But because of the concept, the Shadowcraft was different from Jade Punk in a conceptual basis. And a lot of people liked the Jade Punk bit, I guess.
And what about the fact that you went with a certain rule set? Because it was for Fate, wasn't it?
Both of them were Fate.
Right. So do you think that helped you out because of Fate? Or do you think it was? Yeah, okay.
I was awesome by association. Wow. Jade Punk launched. I launched the Kickstarter like a year, like 14 months after the incredibly successful Fate Core Kickstarter. And during those 14 months, I had on my blog, I was giving away free content left and right. I was showing people how to make Superman and Fate during the core rules with no adjustments, how to do Iron Man, how to make up like scene fractals. I was just giving away. Part of it was me playing in front of people. But I had this idea that I'm just going to give away so much free stuff, earn an audience. And then when I put something out there, that audience is going to push it because of what I've done for them. And it paid off. But yeah, Fate definitely helped. If I had made my own game system, no one would have known about it. I built up a core audience within Fate's audience.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a bubble you want to ride with game systems, though. Like after the Fate Kickstarter, Fate was huge.
Yeah.
And
now not so much.
Yeah. John and I recently released a game. Sorry, forgive me for the shameless self-promotion. But it's relevant because Savage World Adventure Edition came out, and it was a big deal. And we dropped a game book very shortly thereafter. And I think, yeah, we're still number four here on the best-selling. And it was kind of a niche that had been done before. But, you know, it was a strange post-apocalypse, but ours was strange post-apocalypse with kind of a frontier vibe as opposed to the strange post-apocalypse Weird West vibe. We were more frontier. And no one had actually, had never been fleshed out really before. And we aren't Platinum's bestseller. We're Silver, but it's been less than a year. And once again, you know, John's the artist, and art was huge in getting this over. Yeah. Well, this is all John in here. And scrolling through the book, I mean, you can see it's all about setting the tone, getting the vibe. And Sean Noakes, great writer, but you know, just between the layout by Craig and the art by John, sorry. Yeah, it's just that was the best marketing we could have had.
Yeah, and, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
You also hit the core audience of Savage Worlds. They love that Weird West vibe. Frontier isn't so far off that it's like hits them on a kind of a lateral.
Yeah, it was close enough to be familiar, but weird enough to be different.
Yeah.
So.
And it's a funny decision you make as well, isn't it? Because we could have easily have opted to say go for our own system, and you feel as though you might be cheating your creativity a little bit because you think, well, should we jump on the back of a system like Savage World, the same way that you had the Fate going on with yours, Ryan? And you kind of think, well, you know, if it wasn't for that, would it be successful? And then you start, you know, and it's these little conversations you have in your head.
Yeah, I made a game with Paul Michener called Age of Anarchy that was about this very niche historical age of anarchy that existed in England. We made our own system. We spent like 6 months on it. And we loved the system. The system, I love it to death playing it. That game, I think, has made, after the Kickstarter, 10 sales. I didn't drop as much money on the art on that one, but it was a production. But I really think it's because it's my first book of my own system, and I don't have that kind of clout to be able to say I made my own system and here we go.
I never heard about that before, but but yeah, there it is. I tell this story too much, but I went to my local comic shop back in the before times when I would still go to physical places, and the guy had a bunch of D20 books out on a rolling cart right in the front door, marked down like 90%. And so you could pick up all these third-party D20 books for like a buck. And I'm like, what's going on? He's like, we can't figure out the RPG business. We're getting out of it. We'll sell board games, card games, war games, comics, but no fuck RPGs. We're not going to try to do it anymore. And I think this is part of the reason. It's just, it's a hard nut to crack. And so much of it is the D20 boom. Hey, let's follow the leader. D20 is big. Let's put it out. Then all of a sudden, wow, D20 wasn't so big anymore. And a lot of people were left holding on the stock that was, you know, Babes just worthless. Fun.
Well, if you think about the difference, like if you want to buy a movie or you want to buy a novel.
Still there?
Sorry.
I think, there you go.
I got a phone call. all right. I have to do this on my phone. Sorry.
No worries.
If you buy a novel or something or a movie and you read it or watch it one time, that's it. You're done. Mm-hmm. But if you do it with RPG, I bought 5th edition back in 2014. I still use the same book. You've got, you know, it's, I don't need more. You know, I like, Supers is one of my favorite RPG mechanics. I love it by Walt. And with that, like, I bought that when the Kickstarter launched. And then he's given me tons of free supplements with it because we're friends. But I don't, I mean, that's it. Supers is done. I have everything for Supers unless Walt puts out more, which I hope he does.
We're working on some stuff.
Okay. And there's huge backlogs that Dom does for us. So if you go in there, he puts out characters and stuff like that. So, yeah, we got something coming out usually a couple times a month.
Oh, you know we're going to have Dom on the show on Friday. You should come, Walt.
What time?
Why you got to ask me questions, man?
Do I still have a thread on your
You most certainly do. It's one of the more important threads because it's got you just slamming characters like crazy. And everybody's just like, well, how do you want? I want to make Daredevil. Go to this thread. It's Ryan's thread.
So is it still relevant? Because I'll totally come back and make more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. People go in and they're just like, and anytime somebody wants to know how to make a character, rather than saying, oh, you know, and then go into this, you know, 20-page piece of exposition, I'm like, go to Ryan's thread.
All right.
Even Balder agrees.
DT Pacino is going to be on talking to us 2 p.m. Eastern Friday. So enjoy your turkey coma. Come on. Oh, you said Dom. I said DT. Sorry. Didn't sleep last night. Forgive me. But their names both start with D, so they're supposed to be in the same guy. They're both in the Northeast.
One guy has a goatee and is a little pasty, and Dom is a big giant sheriff from Virginia.
Mm. All right, so different dudes. My bad. Sorry about that. We should have Dom on though.
But they are both fantastic, fantastic people. They're excellent, excellent role playing game resources, and both have their core audiences that really are fanatic about them.
Dom's a real Supers fanatic, isn't he?
Oh yeah, yeah. He's big on Supers and superheroes and stuff like that. But you know, most people don't realize that he is a wealth of knowledge and has done consultations in regards to like military authenticity. He's written for major magazines worldwide in several different countries on tactics and stuff like that because he's a tactics instructor for the sheriff's department. In fact, we served in the same area of Iraq together, and God, back maybe 10 years ago now, a little over 10 years ago now, we were both on the atomic think tank. And he was
old school. Yeah, yeah.
Right? Right? And he was like, yeah, man, so I'll catch you later because I'm going to be going out the house. I'm like, oh, yeah, me too. I said, where are you going? He goes, oh, I can't talk about it. So like a week later, I changed on everywhere that I was typing at the time. I changed my status to, you know, where are you? And it just said somewhere Iraq. Mm-hmm. Right. And he called up and he's like, motherfucker, you didn't tell me you were in Iraq. Dude, I'm down the street. We need to go get coffee. So yeah, I hooked up with him a week later and I'm like, you know, he came out of rotation and had a refit to do on one of our vehicles. So I caught him at the barbershop and I'm like, let's go get some food and stuff, you know, with, you know, non-real bacon Subway sandwiches and whatever, because you can't have bacon in those countries, unfortunately. But anyway,
you're in a coffee shop.
I am not in a coffee shop. I am using the magic of I am in the magic of the interwebs. In fact, John was very observant, you know, because John is also a former military dude, and he noticed that the dude in the window of the door hasn't moved for like 20 minutes.
Yeah, he's not doing a bit. That's just a picture.
Yeah.
So, you know, somehow we were going to talk about fiction writing, and we're talking about RPGs and coffee shops.
So, to get back on the topic, since you mentioned that post was pragmatic, I think the most pragmatic advice I have in selling books as a product, too many people look at it as an art form. And the truth is, none of us are going to be the next fucking Shakespeare. It's just not going to happen. Or it might, but Shakespeare was, I mean, fairly broke, I think. And most writers of that stature were.
Well, I think a lot of people point out that, you know, Shakespeare, okay, greatest English writer, but he was writing for a specific audience. He was writing his plays to suit certain patrons, certain audience. He was trying to sell tickets and put butts in seats. Yeah. And you mentioned your post. Do you think of your book as a product? Who am I marketing it to? How am I marketing it to them? What's their experience with me on social media? What's their experience going through the book? And you try to do that stuff deliberately. So you're not just kind of, you know, hoping it becomes artistic along the way, you know, craft a specific experience, you know, for people who are getting, you know, getting into your stuff. And
the story has to be good. I mean, you have to have a good story. Otherwise, why are you doing it? But the two most important things is that cover art. That's what makes people click. And then the most important paragraph of your entire story is the description of your story. Not even in your book. You could, in fact, you wouldn't sell very much of your second book, but you could sell a shit ton of your first book if you had excellent cover art and a kick-ass description and the story sucked. You would sell a ton, but nobody would come back. For your second one, but you could. I think those are the two most important elements. And then having a story that brings back people if you want to do this longer than one shot.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if I go into a bookstore to buy a book, chances are I'm buying a book that's either A, been recommended by somebody else, or if I go in there blind, as in not having a recommended book, you gravitate to the cover art. So it's very rare that you'll go into a book and pick up, you know, a black cover unless, you know, and go, oh, yeah, I'll buy that. You know, it's always, it was something that someone said, read this book, or it's something that grabs your eye.
Yeah. And if you have inside one novel thing, just one thing that's like, this was a really big idea that I don't think anyone's done before or meshed this together before, that's going to get people talking about it and recommending it. And then for the browsers, the awesome cover. Especially like scrolling through Amazon, you gotta have that awesome cover. And then the description to convert sales, you can actually look and see on their tools if someone clicked on your cover but didn't buy it. And that means your description sucks and you need to go fix it. But if one novel thing inside, like Jade Punk has the, what is it called now? The asset system that nobody had done before, and that is the thing that Fate people are like, I want to see that system. And I get people who buy the book just to see that system, and that's the novel, one novel thing that I bring people in for the recommendation. So you want kind of the three things. You want the art to draw the eye, you want the description to interest people who are just first timers, and you want that novel thing that causes somebody to recommend it. Even if you executed terribly around that thing, but that one thing was interesting and made it memorable. In my opinion, those three things are necessary.
It's funny though when you talk about cover art, because I think generally here we're talking about fantasy or science fiction novel writing, aren't we, ultimately? Mm-hmm. Because if you look at kind of say, if you go into a bookshop and look at say the thrillers especially, 9 times out of 10, cover art for thrillers tends to be just a photo manipulated person with a wispy background. You know what I mean? It's not what I would call proper cover artwork. While the fantasy and sci-fi world tends to go for the more elaborate and properly painted covers. And yet, obviously, when it comes down to, say, the thrillers are the biggest sellers in books. So what's the problem there? Why aren't they benefiting from the better cover art?
So go ahead, please. So I think there's if you have someone like James Patterson, the best-selling author of all time, his name's James Patterson, so he slaps that on a book with a black background and it sells. But then there's a guy, I can't remember his last name, but his first name's Mark. He's a very big author in the thriller area. He does artistic covers of like what we think special forces or spies should look like, with the, you know, the decked out tech and stuff. And the covers are really pretty. I don't know if that contributes, but I know that that caught my eye, and that's why I know who he is. Except I can't remember his last name. But he does a lot of those artistic books. So I think maybe it's a factor of having your name well known. And most thrillers, that you know, they're well known. Or if you're not so well known, drop that money on that cover.
I think as well is you probably find that if you've got someone who's well known, they tend to be part of a large publishing house. And the publishing house is the people who make a decision about the cover art. So they're not interested in spending money on the art. They'll just throw someone's name on it. If you're looking at someone who's not very well known, they might be self-publishing. So they'll probably fork out the money in advance and come up with a cover art concept, if you know what I mean, to sell it forward. I think, talking from an artist's point of view, the publishers in the world, the big publishing houses, have destroyed, in my opinion, proper painted covers like you used to get back in the day. You know, you just don't get it really nowadays. You know, you have to go to small press or to independent authors, really, to see a decent cover, I think, you know.
I think some of it's the audience and what they expect, too. I remember reading an article years ago about how when they were marketing science fiction to a British crowd versus an American audience, American covers were very, hey, here's a couple characters doing something. And British were much more landscapes. Here's a couple guys in the corner against, you know, breathtaking vista kind of thing. And it was just market research and what sold better, you know, and who knows what's the psychology behind it. But I was trying to get a cheap laugh out of this firefighter military romance cover, and no one rose to the bait. So I'm very disappointed you guys were being too mature for my bullshit.
Sorry, Mike, I thought you'd accidentally pressed your
wish list.
That's my special alone time reading. Yes.
Well, you know what's interesting, when you pop that up, it did create a thought in my mind that they don't need to go very far to find a hot, you know, firefighter, or what is supposed to be a firefighter. But I can't go into my backyard or even down the street and find a starship or an orc.
I
need that art in order to show those. But you know, the more thriller stuff, I can show a building and then Photoshop it to be on fire, or even find photos of buildings on fire.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet this. We could probably do an image search and find something very close to this on Stuttershock or Shutterstock or 100 other places. So
yeah, a friend of mine does covers like that, and she goes on Stuttershock or Shutterstock and gets the photo.
It's hard to say, right? Yeah. So Walt, you can't share those images with us. Your upcoming novel pictures, you can't show those to us.
Nope. Sorry, lockdown still. Almost. Right. So we're in other contract negotiations in regards to like audio and stuff. So I can't show anything. But
can I show the image John did for you, or is that also lockdown?
Oh no, I can get that. Hold on. One of the big things about covers that makes them so appealing is it kind of gives you a preview of the story before you actually get into the story. It's very important to make sure that, you know, as evocative as a cover is, you have to understand that as people are scrolling through Amazon and stuff like that, there's been a ton of market research that suggests that if they can't read the title from the thumbnail, they're not going to click the book. They're not going to look at it. They're not going to do whatever. You could have this evocative title that just, you know, it raises the goose flesh on your neck, and you're just like, oh yes, this is amazing. They're not going to do it because they can't see it on the cover. Typography is very important, and evocative cover is very important. What's really interesting nowadays is that people are taking flack because right now, military thriller, military science fiction, all very popular. So guys like myself, guys like John, who know what they're doing and know what something should look like, are being consulted, and people are coming up. And just the other day, I had somebody who said, you know, who watches my Coffee and Concept show on Keystroke Medium, and he says, hey, you know, I asked around, and you're pretty well known for your military knowledge. Would you look at my cover and tell me what you think? And I said, yeah, no problem. I'll take a look for you. So I looked at it and I said, this blows egg rolls. Don't use it. If you want military authenticity, do not use it. If you don't mind like the CW version of the military, then fine. It's good. Use it. He's like, well, what's wrong? I said, all right, here's the problem. I said, you have a woman. She's holding the gun like this. First of all, her thumbs are behind where the hammer is going to cock back. So when the slide actually comes back, it's going to cut her fucking thumbs off. That's number one. Number two, I said she's got her finger on the trigger with the gun next to her head. If she accidentally slips, bumps into anything, gets an exciting thought, or possibly even sees a taco and pulls that trigger, she's said goodbye to her hearing for the rest of the week, possibly the month. She might even blow out an eardrum, depending on the caliber of the weapon. I said, next, and don't get me started on the way the armor is being worn. I'm like, the armor is not set up properly. I said, is this person supposed to be like a special agent or like a super trooper or some crap? And he's like, well, she's special forces. I'm like, first of all, there are no female special forces that were around when you were writing this book. So no, she's not. I said, secondly, the way she's got her armor, you can tell that the artist had no effing clue what goes where and why you wear it there. I said, that is my opinion if you are looking for a realistic cover. I said, otherwise, the art is beautiful, the model is beautiful, and the gun is easily identifiable in the shot. But just remember that the reason the gun is up there like this is because for the very reason you can see me in screen, TV executives during the 1970s said, bring the gun up near your face. It'll be in the shot, and it'll be very, very, very wild, and people will get excited. The problem is that that also filtered into the police department and throughout all the United States. They spent decades trying to rid people of that stupid habit. It's dumb. It's idiotic. And whoever allowed that to filter into actual tactical society should be slapped vigorously or allowed to carry a gun like that. And when it goes off, they're their own worst enemy. But the guy was horrified. He's like, I said, don't even get me started, because she's got her finger placed on the trigger. I'm like, real operators don't do that. They keep their finger on the side of the magwell or the frame until it's time to use a weapon, because it violates rule number two. He goes, wait a minute, what's rule number two? I said, there are three basic rules to firearms use. If you don't know them, you shouldn't be writing about firearms. He's like, well, can you tell me? I'm like, go on the internet.
How often is your answer not blows egg rolls?
Not very often.
I figured that.
However, I'm very lucky in that I get to talk to a variety of very talented, very successful former military high-ranking NCOs, high-ranking officers who now write books, and they understand these things. So now we are seeing covers where they're getting their input into those artists, and you're seeing covers with trigger discipline, muzzle discipline. Can't tell. Do you know what flagging is? Have you ever heard of that term? John knows what it is, right? So flagging is when you take the barrel of your weapon and pass it by or in direct line of where one of your buddies is walking.
We call it covering. Right?
Yeah. Yep. So we call that flagging in the military, right? Because you just ran your flag right across his dome. So if that weapon goes off, you see it all the time in the movies. It's like somebody's going to turn a corner or whatever, and they go like this. Whoop, they bring the weapon online, and then they turn and bring it right across their buddy, right? So if he gets excited and like, bad guy, poof, right? Good old Ted that you just had breakfast with this morning isn't going to have breakfast with you tomorrow, right? So
I did that to a friend in paintball.
Oh, yep. It is much less forgiving with bullets. So
yeah, sure. It's funny because I did a cover recently for a self-publishing author, and I completed it and I sent it off to him, and he came back with a few queries and things he wanted to change. And one of the things he wanted to change was he wanted the guy's finger on the trigger. No, I know. But,
did your eyes start twitching?
No, I had to do it because I thought, well, and he said, well, why? Where's his finger? He couldn't see it. He says, well, it's behind you can't see the angle. It's behind the trigger. Yeah, but I can't. So I had to put the trigger in. The finger in. And it's one of those things you've got to do. In fact, you know what? Let me just show you now. You'll have to laugh. Can I see it?
Yeah, if you put it up on the screen, Mike can share it.
Yep, go for it.
Can you see this one?
Yeah, I can see his finger through the housing.
Yeah, you see there? You just see his little finger.
And he's once again, built. he's got the weapon up in the frame.
No, right? No. But you know.
It's Charlie's Angel pose, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's a gorgeous cover, though.
It is pretty. Yeah, it is. I was just going to say.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. John does nice work.
That's the thing, man. I was pimping you the other day on the Galaxy's Edge podcast. And, man, the mere sight of your artwork across the screen, because I shared it on my screen, man, panties were rocket propelled through the floor.
Nice.
I mean, that crew was just like, that's a drawn picture. I'm like, yes, it is. Now we gotta find this dude immediately. I said, well, you know, they just put out a book called The After. You know, click, 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 click. So yeah, they were super, super stoked.
You know, Walt, maybe you should do like paid online seminars where you talk to, you know, because there's a lot of people trying to write military sci-fi or military fiction right now who don't have this kind of knowledge. You could do like seminars monthly, or, you know, you could even charge for that stuff.
Well, there are guys out there who are doing that. Mm-hmm. And the only problem is, you know, if I'm doing that, I'm not doing all the other stuff. Okay. So, but like the other day I had a fellow author contact me and was like, hey, your name was floated around because you understand military parachuting. And I'm like, that is correct. Mm-hmm. And they were like, okay,
Someone watched the podcast.
What's that?
Someone watched the last podcast.
Right.
Our audience of dozens is growing.
And I said, yeah, it is. Now, you know, and the person in the story should not have been doing what they were doing. Mm-hmm. You know, and there were several tweaks me and this author back and forth, because it's just like this does not work. I said, like I told the people with the covers, I said, you know, if you're looking for a CW version of the military, that works. I said, because nobody's going to care, because nobody knows. If you're looking to have a veteran read it and say, oh yeah, that rocked on toast. You know, and I always go back to like the guys on Galaxy's Edge or Tom Clancy or anything like that, right? Those guys aren't special operators. Tom Clancy didn't even serve in the military, but he had a library card, did his research, yeah. Right? And you read those books and you're just like, oh my God, these guys get it. And you're like, yeah, only half that crew on that book served in the military, and this other guy never served, yeah. You know? But if you have the research, if you go in, dive in, dig deep into the research and actually do the job, you know, so that you sound like you don't know what you're talking about. I mean, it doesn't even have to be 100%. If you get like 75% of it right, you will have an audience that'll follow you throughout several books and stuff like that, because you're catering to what they've experienced, and they're going to want more of that. Because John will tell you, no matter how bad it sucked when you were being rained on, you were cold, tired, hungry, you were missing your family, the holidays were going to suck. No matter what was going on, life was hard. And then when you get out of the military and life is easy, it's all you can think about is like, damn, I miss that stuff.
It's also true for martial artists, for role-playing games. Mm-hmm. I am always so disappointed in every version of a monk or someone who's supposed to be the martial arts character. And I have in mind what I want to do for a martial arts character, and it's impossible to do. And I'm like, no, that should be done. I should be allowed to, like, the monk not in fifth edition, the monk not being able to use a longsword, right? Or even a fencing weapon like a Jian, mm-hmm. is ridiculous. And not being good grapplers. They should be the only good grapplers. So it's to me, I was just like, oh my, and I'm like that every time. And you do lose part of your audience because of that. I was in the military, but it finally clicked for me when I was thinking about the monk just now, since we were talking about role-playing earlier.
And that's the thing, you know, yeah, you have to balance the elements of a story with the elements of realism, because at the end of the day, if you look at Batman, that dude's got a year tops of doing what he's doing, the way he's doing it.
Yeah. You know?
His knees.
if you've ever read The Psychology and Traumas of Batman, which was an article published, God, it had to be over 10, 15 years ago now, by a college student, just the trauma to his knees, right? you would be crippled within months. You know, like, you look at the way military operators let's go the martial arts route, right? So somebody sent me a video the other day, and they're like, hey, what do you think of this awesomeness? And I look, and it's a Chinese martial artist doing Muay Thai, right? He's kicking trees. He's kicking bricks. And I said, all right, this is awful. I said, they're like, yeah, but look at how – I said, stop. I said, first of all, if you're looking at breaking stuff, right, the way that he's breaking it, I said, he's using techniques that are designed to destroy muscle on hard targets. I said, if you go to the Philippines, right? Not the Philippines. If you go to Thailand, right? And you look at those fighters, they don't do this crap. And I'll tell you why. The average Muay Thai fighter, right, makes more in 1 month than he's going to make in 4 years of working at a tire factory, right? So are you going to risk breaking a bone and possibly losing? Now, Muay Thai fighters typically in Thailand, 2 year career. That's it. Right. So you're going to risk being out on an injury for part of that 2 years when you're considered in your prime by doing something stupid like kicking a banana tree, even though they're soft and spongy, you can still rupture a shin. You turn your ankle in that soft mud, you're out. Right. Sure. You watch those guys train. They are padded from head to toe because they don't want to damage the moneymaker, which is from nose to toes. Right. So somebody sends me something like that, and they're like, this is awesome. We should put this in a book. No, it's not awesome. Don't put it in a book. It sucks. It's an idiot trying to get likes on an internet video. I'm like, this guy does not know how Muay Thai is supposed to operate. Doesn't know what he's doing. I said, at most, he's probably had some Chinese hard palm training or iron palm training or something like that and transitioned it to his legs. And now he's putting on a pair of Thai shorts and faking the game. But it'll get likes on a video. It doesn't do justice to the real thing.
Yeah, there was.
You were talking about Batman, for example. I mean, I'm a really big Punisher fan. I mean, you know, any Punisher graphic novels ever come out, I bought. Don't talk to me about the series. It was crap, right? but you know, I love Punisher. However, you know, I can read a graphic novel of Punisher, and he probably gets shot about 20 times in one. He gets tortured at least twice in every graphic novel. So I mean, you know, the guy must get shot once or twice a month, you know, and you know, blood edge trauma on a nightly basis.
Oh yeah.
Like the Daredevil show.
And these guys are not meant to have superpowers, are they? These guys, oh, no. I mean, Daredevil has to some extent, hasn't he, a little bit? But, you know, the Punisher's just meant to be just a mean, highly trained dude, you know?
Yeah. There was a book in 2009. I went to Comic-Con that year. It was the only year that I was able to go. And they had, the book was called Becoming Batman. And it was written by this physiologist or physical science guy, or some, I don't remember, something to do with the body. But he broke down the whole concept of the book, because he was a martial artist and everything, was how to turn an average person into what we think is Batman and all the different things you'd have to train in and all of this. When he breaks it down, he said, okay, here's what Batman would look like if you made him in real life. And it was ridiculous. It was impossible. And then he said, now, if you want to be like Batman, you could do these things. And then he broke down like the career of Batman and how it was basically like 1 year. Like he said, and also he can't lose. If he loses one time, he's just dead. There's no, in real life, they're not going to strap him to a chair and monologue for half an hour. He's dead. So it was really interesting read, and I got to see the author talk about it in a big, in a big hall and stuff. It was pretty cool.
What's really funny is if you look at just the martial arts aspect of Batman, the particular training that he has that makes it supposedly he's an expert in 27 different martial arts, that would take most of his adult life in order to learn.
Oh yeah, and in real life he would only learn like an MMA fighter plus the specific things he needs. And he would have a strategy. He wouldn't engage with big guys. That's what I like about Hush. In the beginning of Hush, he went in and he was going down this hallway, the stairwell, and he kept running into bad guys, and he identified what they were strong at, like a big dude or something like that. And he used a different tool to hit their weakness and avoid their strength. And you'd have to be brilliant like that. And it's real to bring it back to like writing. It's realistic to have characters do that or not, depending on your audience. If this is, Bat God is a thing for a reason. Some people really dig the idea that a human can compete with Superman, even though it's preposterous and the movie sucked.
But I think if I'm reading a novel and the main protagonist or hero, etc., they've been injured, you know, I like it when you're reading the pain they're going through or the problems they have. When one gets shot in the shoulder and he's got to suffer with that shoulder wound for a couple of chapters of the book, I think that's really good ammunition for a writer. That's giving them a huge amount of play that they can use for that character, especially if the character is someone who normally is not superhuman, but is normally shit up in whatever they're doing to suffer that wound, which puts them at puts them at an inconvenience to doing other things. Is great stuff from a writer's point of view, and it's good. It's good for a reader, I think.
Especially if they revisit it in the next book. Like he has that shoulder injury. The worst thing in the world is reading a book and a dude gets stabbed in the leg, and they never revisit it, and it was just a momentary thing. It's like, no, dude got stabbed in one of the biggest areas of his body. There's some trauma there, and he's just going to walk up a mountain after? No, dude. Yeah. Sorry.
My wife caught me. I was leaning over the back of my chair, and I had a book open in my hand, and I was just kind of swinging in the chair back and forth, and she goes, "Book not doing it for you?" I said, "It was until I got to this part." She goes, "What?" Now, my wife used to be a soldier. So she's like, "What happened?" I said, SC dub with a full conversation going on. I said, before an occlusive dressing, right? So basically the guy had a sucking chest wound and he was having a conversation with the medic. That right there. No, done. No, there's no conversation going on. Cause the only thing he's doing is either coughing blood or he's choking. Right. And then, the medic was going to like put a bandage on him, and I'm like, oh my god, they didn't even do the research. And it's just like, you read that and you're like I've seen that wound. You're not having a regular conversation. He's fighting for every breath right now. Especially if his lung starts filling up with blood and he gets tension pneumothorax, where the blood actually pushes on the lung and forces the trachea to one side, forcing you to choke. And I'm like, no. I mean, he could have been sat up and been like, pointing and stuff like that. But it's so hard to just even get a breath with that injury. And I'm just like, and then, like you were saying, a couple of chapters later, he's like, "Hey, remember when you were shot in the chest?" It's like, "Oh yeah, blah, blah, blah." And he's putting deadlifts up, and it's just like, oh my God.
At least watch The Good Doctor and come and make it a creative scene.
Yeah.
And then talk to the next scene.
So, Ryan, just out of curiosity, I mean, we talk about military fiction, military science fiction a lot. And let me call out, this is a cover John did for Walt, and I love it. I
think gorgeous.
Yeah.
Is that the one up right now?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. But I mean, one of the classic pieces of advice at writer symposiums or conventions or reading Writer's Digest is find a niche audience that's not served well, or that can be served more. And military fiction, military science fiction is kind of evergreen that way, because those guys like to buy books. And there's more, I had a writer teacher one time, he's like, if you can find a niche that no one has explored yet, like if you can start writing bass fishing mysteries and no one has done that before, you could be the guy in that niche. It's not art, but you're talking about, there's people who want to be entertained in that niche that you're not doing. I've always wondered, why isn't there more martial arts fiction? Because it seems like
It is, and that's one of my rules. Because like when I was doing Jade Punk, I had this idea that Western gunslingers and knights errant are, at least the romantic version of Western gunslingers and errant knights, are no different. They both wander the world solving problems with whatever's on their hip, and that was what created the idea of this Eastern Western mashup of, the Zhang Wu and the Westerns. And it started like evolving from that. But it really, I think if you're looking for a story idea that's going to hit a niche that no one's meeting, it's the one where, and it's old advice, but nobody takes it to heart because they all lock up and think, oh, this won't sell because no one else is doing it. No one else is doing it. But it really is write what you wish was out there, what you want to read. Because if it's not out there for you to find it, you really want it, someone else really wants it too. Like, I want to write this fantasy story, and I really want to write it bad, of these dragon-riding orcs against these griffin-riding knights. And I know that there are elements of that out there somewhere, but to really focus on the concept of the Griffin Rider as this elite force in this military, and for some reason they haven't been riding Griffins for the last several decades, but there's a chosen one that's going to come and speak to the Griffins, and they're going to ride. Like, that's cool, and it's got a cavalry feel that I don't know that's being done. And because I can't find it, if I wrote it, there would be a niche fantasy audience that's like, I dig. And I know it's not huge, because even D&D doesn't make dragon riding very well, even though they just did with the Ranger subclass. But, you know, no one really pushes that very much. So I think that if you find that thing, and martial arts, like you said, is one of those things where the book Iron and Silk, I was really, really hoping was going to be this epic fantasy Iron Fist tale. And it was just this dude who went to China and learned martial arts. But it was still interesting and fun for me to read as a martial artist, and they don't have a lot of that anymore.
Well, it's like, do you remember there was a really good film, I can't think it's called now, it was a French film about, they thought they were hunting a werewolf and it ended up being a lion. There was the martial artist.
Yeah, Brotherhood of the Wolf.
That's the one, Brotherhood of the Wolf. Oh,
yes. Yeah, Luc de Garou.
Yeah,
the Pack absolutely. Of the Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Brilliant film, although you must watch it in French with subtitles, not the dub version, which is absolutely awful. But again, you know, it's like, I think it was like the 18th century, and the guy's sidekick was a shit-up martial artist, and it came out of nowhere.
Now, here's the cool thing, right, that we're going to tie this back to the episode we did the other day with Mike, and we were watching the Batman trailer,
mm-hmm.
Oh, right? Yeah. The 1970s, right? The guy that is voicing Robin is the same guy as the Iroquois martial artist in
Mark
that film.
Mark Dacascos, is it?
Yep, that's him.
Yeah, he's
in everything.
Yeah.
And you know what's interesting? Because Mark Dacascos was big when I got into martial arts. I kind of wanted to be him and only the strong. I started training capoeira so I could be Mark Dacascos there.
You just like the berimbau, that instrument, right?
Oh, dude, I love it, man. I was – back then, martial arts was – something interesting that people wanted to see on TV. And then when Blade came out, I think that's where it started to change, because martial arts and Matrix 2 became a subgenre of whatever it was they're making. And then superhero movies and everything else, and martial arts was part of it. And then in order to get Hollywood or anyone to make a martial arts movie, it had to be a historical Ip Man or something like that. But to go back and make just a martial arts movie today, probably hard to get sold.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a bunch of hardcore martial artists out there who just want to read about somebody going through the trials and the struggles of learning martial arts. And if you can adapt that to a more fantastical read, like, I love the Iron Fist show on Netflix. I don't think the dude who played Danny Rand has ever fought or trained a day in his life. But the story of the martial arts, and when he goes in there and he's doing, like, messing with the katana, and Colleen says, you're dishonoring my katana with your kung fu bullshit. I was like, oh, they get it. They understand it. They understand the rivalries and all of that. And it just brought so much realism to it. And especially when the martial arts teacher was broke and begging for students, I was like, yes, okay. Because if you watch Karate Kid and he opens the school and a week later he's doing good. No, it's not the reality. You know, but I love that stuff.
I almost want to ask about Cobra Kai, but that's probably a whole other episode.
That's actually what itself. I meant was Cobra Kai. But
Yeah, I had to watch that with my wife recently.
Oh, I couldn't get past the first episode.
I enjoyed it if I put it, I have to disassociate myself from good martial arts, but I enjoyed the fantasy of it. Which is probably the audience that we're talking about. It's probably the audience that enjoy Cobra Kai.
Just like I thought Iron Fist was garbage martial arts. I think the new Karate Kid is the same, because they did not have Fumio Demura doing the martial arts or any of his students. And you ended up with, when in one of the episodes where they start doing capoeira tricks in the guy's karate, I'm like, nope, I'm done.
What I didn't understand was, you know, when he was younger, when he was training, say, 5, 6, 7 days a week, He got beaten by a kid who's been doing it for 6 months with some stupid crane maneuver, right? and then he's not been doing it for, say, 25 years, and suddenly he takes on 4 or 5 guys outside this motel, right? And it was just like, come on.
Really? Yeah, exactly.
It's like Ray learning the force in, like, 10 seconds.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, I think we had talked about
that's,
before.
That's, I think, a symptom of the kind of society we live in, that is instant gratification. Yeah. We did thing, even though he trained all these years beforehand, that knowledge is instantly available. Yeah. It'll be there when you need it.
Right. Yeah. Cool.
At least show us a training montage.
The first time he tries to do a high kick, he basically tears his hamstring. You know, we've all been there. And then he wakes up the following morning, he's got black and blue bruises under his groin.
You know?
Yeah.
That's if he can even look that far.
Which is something that I – do you guys know any books that do good training montages in a book form, a novella, like a novel form? Because I like that concept of, okay, we built up to the point where they're going to train. Training's fun, but not for everyone. Let me do a little montage. And I feel like that's just the description of the next chapter where it goes over the last 2 years.
So there's a couple that I've read. One of them is one of my favorite books from when I was a kid. It's by David Morrell. He's the guy that wrote the original story of like First Blood and all those books. The books, not the movies. His books are very different from the movies. In the books, he goes into the trauma of Vietnam vets and what they were suffering. In the movies, it was like, oh, I'll kill you. So, David Morrell wrote this, this amazing book. Ryan, this book is like martial arts crack. It's called The Fifth Profession, right? And I won't tell you what the five professions are. Right, because they go into it in the beginning of the book.
Is it like the Japanese professions, the historical ones?
No. They go into that. I don't want to spoil it for you because book is really good. I recently reread it. It's a little dated because it was written in the 80s, so there is that level of technology.
It's like that ninja book.
Not so much ninja, but I'm not going to even tell you what it's about. It's just good. But there's training montages in there when these two people who are from separate societies have to work together. So they have to train together in order to make what they're going to do next work. So that's really good. I sent recently John a book, Legionnaire. They did a prequel
based on the movie.
No.
Galaxy's Edge, isn't it?
Galaxy's Edge Legionnaire, right? So this is like if you are sick of all this garbage that Disney was putting out and you wanted Star Wars that was fun for people who wanted it to make sense. So they did a prequel trilogy called the Savage Wars, which is this big period of time where the people who went out end up fighting like the people who went out at the same time but didn't have faster than light travel, and they get to the same place at different times and this huge fight dusts up. There's in the third book, Savage Wars, there it is, the third book, the one on the right, is called The Hundred, and they have a training montage where it's in Gods and Legionnaires. That's right. It's in Gods and Legionnaires, the middle one with the red cover. There's a training montage where they are training these guys to take on the savage threat. And they said, you know, the current military isn't equipped to deal with these guys. We need something new. And it's very, if you've ever read the book Inside the Delta Force, the training montages that are real life and real world in that are some of the best reading you will do, hands down, just for the sheer savage nature of the training that they put guys through to create the first ever tier one operators, and just the simplicity of the training. You know, you sit there and you look at that and you're like, that is fantastic. So Inside the Delta Force is an amazing, amazing book that covers like the creation of that particular unit. And they kind of almost made an homage to that in Gods and Legionnaires when they are training the first sections of the Legion. It's one of the best training like montages of I've seen in a book in a really long time. So yeah,
it's funny when I read that book. Well, really good book, but I know we discussed this early on when we talked about you can tell when these people have got some military experience writing a novel. And my only thing I would say about that book is, I do think that it'd be interesting to see the demographic of the readers of those novels, because I don't think for someone who's not, say, A, got a military background, or B, not necessarily high into the military kind of stuff, I think they might struggle picking that book up.
When Walt recommended on Facebook the first couple, I bought one and the first one and tried to read it. And I don't think I got through like the third chapter, because I was like, there's a lot of detail, and I'm more Dungeon World, less GURPS in my reading. I want a little more like, let's get to the story. And it's like, I remember he was like, they were fighting, they just dropped ship or something, and he was running across this area and meeting with these people and running over here and fighting there and running over here. And I was like, fuck, this guy runs a lot. And
well, that's you do.
It was interesting, like, but it felt like I was watching a documentary, like, instead of
one of the big influences story. On that book is a book called House to House, and it's the story of Rangers in Fallujah in 2006, and it informs a lot of the narrative on that. So yeah, you're not wrong.
Yeah. There's lots of use of acronyms. Acronyms, are the right words?
Yeah.
So there's lots of use of that, and it does. It can either distract you as a reader, if you don't know what it's about and you don't understand them. I'm not from the States, so there's a lot of stuff I didn't understand, because basically the terminologies are very, very different to what I would use.
Right.
Sometimes I was really going, okay, what does that mean? And I sort of had to go, okay, I'll roll with it and just carry on, if you know what I mean, and get to grips with it later on. But I do think for someone who's not from that background, I think they would struggle with those novels. Like Ryan says, I think you would.
It's funny, because when we have the Galaxy's Edge podcast, the demographic is actually 3-1. So for every three civilians who've read it, a military guy reads it.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say the way around.
It's pretty funny. Funny when you get people on and you're talking to them, and it's like, all right, well, tell me a little bit about your background. And they're like, oh, I drive a truck. I'm like, oh, what'd you do in the military? Oh, I never served. Oh, cool. but what the interesting part about that is, even though they never served, they know somebody or are related to somebody.
Yeah, they can relate to it.
Yeah.
And it might just be that I know a little, I know enough about the military that when I read this, I'm like, okay, I know enough to get it. But then this, I can tell, kind of like if you're reading a fantasy novel and they go over in detail how they strap the armor on, and if they ever mention a piece of the armor, like a pauldron or one of the lesser known pieces than the gauntlet or some breastplate, right? And they're like going in detail, I'm like, okay, so you read a book, or you're into European martial arts and all that, and you want to show everybody how much you know. Those scenes annoy me, but some people, they're going to be all into that.
Right.
And I think that's what it is some people dig that and they want to know more. And when they see that military stuff, they're like, yeah. Cause they're the guys that love watching Saving Private Ryan, you know, on repeat.
But you don't need to include that level of detail though, to get a good military novel. I mean, talking about graphic novels, I used to love Alien Legion. Alien Legion was in the past, I was a massive fanboy of that. And I thought my dream is one day to work on getting the license and doing the role-playing game so I can draw shit for Alien Legion. But, I mean, that was a totally military sci-fi graphic novel series. Absolutely. But they didn't really have that terminology as such. If you know what I mean, they had the thing like they call it clicks, 12 clicks away or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. But they didn't need it. You didn't need it to still have that, you know, military aspect to it.
Yeah. And you know, it's unfortunate because when I was mentioning earlier about how martial arts have become this sub element of a movie, when I look at like Pirates of the Caribbean, that puts elements of real sailing in a clearly fictional sailing thing versus Master and Commander, that's basically a real life, real to life, like sailing adventure in that, we're in that same time period. I'm like, okay, Master and Commander was fun once, but I'll watch Pirates all the time. And it's unfortunate because just like I would love martial arts novels, there are people who would really love more Master and Commanders.
Yeah, and I mean, aside from being entertaining, there's marketing. And Master and Commander had kind of not a great marketing campaign, at least in the U.S. It had trouble finding an audience when it was released. It was competing against a bunch of other stuff. And it is the top of the hour, so I need to get back to my soul-deadening job on this laptop over here. I just want to wrap things up saying, Ryan, I'd love to see some Jade Punk stories from you if you ever want to get it. It seems like that's something that would be fun to read.
I have an outline for Fistful of Jade after we talked about it. I decided I'm going to do it, and then I started on it, and I am having trouble. So I'm probably going to go back to what I was working on. But I do want to do – I have one story in mind, probably just one and done, maybe more, but I do have that Fistful of Jade idea I want to do.
All right, cool. Well, you got to wrap things up. Anyone closing thoughts before we sign off?
I apologize about the angry animals.
Next time we'll talk about more about writing.
Well, we did it away.
Yeah, we did. We could talk about outlining next time. I keep wanting to have a show talking about pantsing versus outlining, and maybe that's our subject for next week. And
I have some really good ideas on that.
Okay, cool. Let's talk about them next Wednesday. And to all our listeners and viewers in the U.S., happy Thanksgiving tomorrow. Enjoy your turkey coma. And you should come back on Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. We'll be talking to D.T. Pacino, not Dom Sumner, who's also a good guy, about his Mutants and Masterminds releases and his art. So until next time, thanks for watching the BAM Podcast. Bab.
Thank you for watching the BAM Podcast.
Someone asked me if Nightcrawler was on the BAM Podcast today.
Right here, man.